welcome to the Big Anxiety podcast series. We're recording on Gadigal land in the studios of 2RPH, a community radio station and radio reading service in Sydney. My name is Beck Dean. I'm the curator of the Big Anxiety Festival of Art and Science and People, and I'm joined by Sydney-based artist John A. Douglas, who is also an ambassador for the festival this year. Welcome, John.
Hello, Beck.
Now, full disclosure, John and I have worked quite closely together for almost 10 years. And John, for the benefit of our listeners, you're a visual artist working across many mediums, including photography, video, sound, performance, and recently virtual reality. And for the last decade, you've been making work that directly addresses your experience of organ failure and organ transplantation. That's what you've been doing basically for the last 5 years as an extended project called Circles of Fire, which we've been working on quite closely together.
Yeah, and that project started on the back of another project, which was based on my peritoneal dialysis treatment. In order for that project to happen, I needed to have a transplant. In fact, in order for me to continue living, I also had to have a transplant. So it's an interesting intertwining of circumstances that made that work come about. So essentially, when I got the phone call for the transplant, simultaneously the research and development of the work began.
And we've been sort of connecting with each other throughout this time. And I think one of the things that we've struck upon in conversation within a creative capacity and also just checking in with how each other are going is this kind of idea, I guess, that is a bit of a fallacy that's still perpetuated about organ transplantation, which is that the organ gives you a new ticket to life, which it does in a lot of ways, but that it's actually a replacement for the organ that has failed. But what actually happens is a much more complex relationship with the body and mind as well. And it is actually this kind of living with, I guess, the idea of death being held back for a while.
Yeah, I guess I call it an extension of life.
Mm.
So my life has been extended because basically without the transplant, I wouldn't be here now. And that's usually the case for probably the majority of transplant patients. And then after a period of time, you know, if they'd never got that transplant, they probably would have died as well.
This is one of the things that we come to find in your work, Circles of Fire, which is about the repetition of these extremes of being treated and feeling well and then going into kind of cycles of pain and trauma and discomfort that are kind of a part of the living process of living with someone else's organ.
Yeah, and that's directly attributed to the reality of all transplant patients, and that is having, and the paradox of organ transplantation is that the immunosuppressant, that is the anti-rejection drugs that organ transplant patients take, are keeping them alive, but at the same time, those drugs are probably going to eventually kill them in one way or another. So that includes a huge list of side effects. And for me, those side effects have been quite heavy going. And for other people, they're not. Maybe for some younger patients, it all depends. Every transplant patient is different. So for myself, I'm already being treated for skin cancer. I have a lot of psychological, cognitive impairments. It's very difficult for me to read and write. I have problems with fine motor skills, and I have problems with becoming ill from time to time and ending up in hospital. So even as recently this year, I was in and out of hospital in London with an undetectable virus that was caused by having a cold in Sydney and then travelling a long distance on a plane. It can become quite amusing. Like, I know that there's a whole lot of YouTube videos that transplant patients have made of how to go to a public toilet without touching anything. And public toilets on planes are actually my biggest fear. So you have to meticulously make sure you have antiseptic hand rub and, you know, because the risk of infection, those kinds of things. I guess I call these the minefields that regular people aren't aware of. And you're always aware of assessing a situation to see if it is a minefield. You know, I'm an artist, so I go to lots of gallery openings, but the really big ones, including ones that I'm in, have been in, they'll often have a huge thing of food out. And I'm like going, I think I'm okay to eat that celery stick, but I'm definitely not going to have the hummus.
Yeah, especially with double dippers.
Yeah, the dip. Well, you don't know. You just can't take the
You
risk.
Just don't know when those people are going to emerge into public space, do you?
No,
it's
the disgusting. Double dippers are out there and they are our enemy. And I guess one of the things, which is interesting because in terms of anxiety, you do live in this, you know, not an ultra paranoid or heightened state, but you kind of on guard. So one of the things around my work, which was in response to Susan Sontag's illness as metaphor, I took the opposite approach in terms of I need to be a fighter, I need to be like a soldier. In fact, when you first in recovery after surgery, one of the registrars said I was now in boot camp, and that involves compliance to a regime of hygiene, food hygiene, hygiene in the home, exercise. So physical exercise is really good with dealing with a lot of those side effects, and also making me battle ready for the next hospitalization if and when it happens, and there have been several. So the work I did last year at LiveWorks was based on the worst case of that, where in 2016 I contracted a norovirus, which is a common stomach virus. Probably most people who are parents would have had their children have a stomach bug. And as you know, it's pretty horrible. They're vomiting or whatever for like 24 hours and then they were fine. For me, it became a near-death experience where luckily this happened in casualty, but I went from thinking that I was going to lose the organ to thinking I was going to die, and they had fibrillators ready. But luckily I had been doing all that gym work, and I feel that that's what probably kept me alive and able to live through that. But then I was in quarantine and hospitalized for 2 weeks to recover from that infections. That's probably the worst case scenario. And then there's other things like this year I was hospitalized with the cough thing, and that's taken me months to actually get over it. So every time you have one of these episodes, you kind of feel like it's really hard to get back to where you were, especially with working out and doing all of that stuff. And also I'm now dealing with an aging body as well, because I'm almost 60. Yeah.
I mean, you are quite a senior artist, or approaching sort of seniority, I guess.
Apparently, I do qualify for the senior's card next year, and my sister who just turned 60 keeps reminding me of that to let me know that I can get the senior's card, and there are little benefits.
You've been practicing for a long time, I guess, without addressing this area of your life, and the kinds of experiences that you were having were largely hidden from, you know, the art world. Most people, including myself, probably didn't know that you had organ failure. Can you remember the point or any influences that made you decide to address this in your work?
That's a really good question. And the way I've thought about that over the years has actually evolved to now that process is also a common thread with a lot of other artists with non-visible disability, chronic illness. So I guess for me it initially happened when I was on dialysis and I had the idea of doing some kind of live performance. It was actually a friend who suggested that I do some kind of performance, and then I decided to do one around my daily in-house 10-hour dialysis treatment. Peritoneal dialysis, not to be confused with hemodialysis. I guess the original concept around that, the conceptual concern around doing that action as a performative action, was mainly based on a kind of self-therapeutic way of transforming this incredibly boring and mundane experience into some kind of artistic and visually poetic experience that in somehow would make life more bearable and also enable me to sustain having an art practice because it was becoming more and more difficult. Like when you're on dialysis, one of the main things you're dealing with is anemia. You just feel like crap all the time. And you have good crap days and you have bad crap days, but pretty much they're all crap.
You have talked about this life-sustaining properties of being an artist as well and being able to do this work.
Yes.
It's giving you reason and hope and all of these things about living.
Yeah, and that has come across with other artists who make work that speaks to their disability. And even if it doesn't directly speak to their disability or impairment or whatever, you know, otherwise the alternative is I would have just become incredibly depressed and unmotivated and, sure, suicidal. Yeah, so I have a firm belief, and many other artists do, that being able to sustain a practice as a chronically ill person definitely adds to quality of life and longevity. Mm. I don't know why that is. I mean, I know that when I feel like my practice is slipping away or that the opportunities and the doors are closing, I get incredibly depressed.
Mm.
And every work I make it as if it is my last because I don't know how much time I have left, especially as I get older. And every work I make, it's kind of a bit of a conundrum because you have an urgency about trying to get the work out, but because you're impaired, you're delayed. Mm. It does at times become quite frustrating. But I've been incredibly fortunate, of course, to have had your support, Beck.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And also the support of funding bodies. And sometimes I just, you know, I just can't believe when I look back over my life over the last few years that I was able to do all of those things. And the thing is, I make the work not just for me, but I think the other central idea around the work is that, which I noticed when we first did Body Fluid at Carriage Works, is that something happens, especially in a live performance, where you create, it's almost like a sacred space. Like, I'm a full-on atheist, you know, I grew up a Catholic, I'm just like a hardcore anarchist atheist. But something happens when you have some kind of live performance around the body, the medicalized body, as I call it, or the medicalized body as spectacle. The space is transformed to, it almost becomes sacred space. It's really hard to put my finger on it. And you know what I noticed earlier this year when I got to show at Science Gallery London, there was a couple there who are artists and they were doing some work around breastfeeding and biogenomes. And they did a public performance with breastfeeding and then they took the milk and put it in this machine to mix it with the normal, trying to remember, they're like the microbiomes of women.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
okay,
there's
yes.
this new technique that's apparently about avoiding a lot of problems with children in terms of immunity, where a lot of women who have cesareans, they miss out on having this. It's kind of like your natural probiotic that exists. Apparently it's been linked to the reason why children have allergies to gluten and
yes.
peanuts and all this kind of stuff. It was really beautiful little kind of performance in the gallery, very low-key, but I noted that that was also the same thing. It was like this sacred space. It was actually really quite profound too. And there's a kind of a silence that permeated the space and it was really quite moving. So I don't know what that is, but it seems to be that all my work kind of does that. Even when I'm able just to show video or whatever, it does that thing around creating this kind of space.
I mean, I guess one of the reasons I wanted to get you into this conversation around mental health is because you're known as an artist working in relationship to your position within the public health system as a patient, as an artist who is a patient. And we still do some pretty amazing mental gymnastics about kind of separating mental health from physical health and well-being in the body. And I feel like it's one of those things that comes through in your work is about the total experience of the body as a site for emotions and feelings and well-being and health and all of these things that interplay within all of us but are quite rudely separated, I guess, in our society. Is there anything that you want to say specifically about mental health and chronic illness, you know, in your role as ambassador? Is this something that you could say to other people who might be going through these same relationships with this cycle of illness and health and chronic illness? Sorry, it's a long question.
There's also a couple of things I'd like to predicate my answer to around that. And okay, so first of all, for transplant patients specifically, there is a real problem at the moment. Now, when I was first on the recovery ward after surgery, the massive doses of medications that I had, including IV prednisone, caused me to have, I guess you'd call it a kind of psychiatric episode. Mm. And I was actually given a psychiatric medication for a few weeks. However, unfortunately, the hospital that I go to, they have no support services at all for transplant patients. In fact, I think the pre-screening for transplant patients should also be a psychological psychiatric assessment as well, because you're not really prepared for the emotional onslaught. I mean, it's quite terrifying. The whole transplant surgery experience and the medications, the huge dose of medications that you receive afterwards is quite terrifying. And I also had a near-death experience as well, where I almost died when I was on the operating table. And I'm pretty sure I've been living with PTSD since then, along with the side effects. And in fact, I think some of the side effects I have are also related to that as well. There's literally no support where the hospital I attend. And I'm aware that, for example, in the UK and in the US, there is a lot of support for transplant patients prior and after. The only support you get is around the physical. And from what I've been told, it has a lot to do with funding.
Yes.
And from what I've also been told is that doctors, I interviewed right at the beginning when I started researching the project in 2014, and an anaesthetist from Adelaide said to me that the general thing is that doctors don't have time for any kind of feel-good or caretaking kind of stuff. Mm. They're mainly just dealing with balancing your medications and any problems you might be having. So they're only really concerned with the physical aspects of the transplant. So I have tried to reach out. I know there are some support services at another hospital in Sydney, but I haven't been able to successfully access that. Yeah, so I don't know what to say to other people other than that trying to find something that gives you something to look forward to is really, really critical to whatever that is, you know. And I think it is a creative act. It could be writing, it could be, I don't know, and I don't say this in that sort of old school art therapy, basket weaving kind of way. I'm kind of saying it in a way that whatever it is that helps you going, I mean, even just being able to do some kind of exercise program or whatever, just getting out and doing stuff is better than being, I know how it is to be stuck at home and you know, you literally are stuck, and also being stuck in bed as well, feeling helpless and like, or completely unmotivated, or even the thought of trying to address all of that stuff can be quite crippling as well. So, yeah, I don't know if I'm...
Well, I think those relationships and connections with people are so important. And I'm just kind of reflecting on our relationship and how much that has changed my life as well. It's actually changed the direction of my interests as a curator, and the kinds of things that I'm wanting to do in the future as well have been really fundamentally changed by working with you across this time. And I think that's a really important thing to share, is that when we go outside and when we make connections with people, then we have other things to hold on to. And I think that's a really important thing to finish on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with us, John. Really look forward to continuing to work with you over these next years. Thank you so much for coming on board as an ambassador for the Big Anxiety Festival.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And that was John A. Douglas, an ambassador of the Big Anxiety Festival 2019, speaking with Beck Dean, the festival curator. John is an organ transplant recipient who identifies as an artist with chronic illness, which is a non-visible disability. We'd love you to come back and listen to other podcasts featuring artists and festival ambassadors in conversation with Beck Dean, curator of the Big Anxiety, and me, Barbara Sullivan, from Radio 2RPH.